I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and this is The Takeaway. In 2012, former JPMorgan Chase trader Bruno Ixell made headlines as the London Whale for losing $6.2 billion in a series of trades that went south. Despite these disastrous bets, the U.S. Department of Justice has announced that Ixell won't be facing any charges. But in the past few hours, it's emerged that the U.S. is going after two other former JPMorgan Chase employees for their roles in the London Whale scandal. Charges have now been brought against two derivatives traders for conspiracy, fraud, falsifying books, and making false statements. Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S. and helped explain the charges being brought down today.
Well, they're bringing charges against Javier Martín Artajo, who ran the London operations of what was known as J.P. Morgan's chief investment office. It was this really powerful investing arm of the bank that controlled $350 billion. So Martín Artajo was really the head trader, and he was the one who oversaw all of the trades and who was essentially the boss. There were people above him, but he was the one with real tangible power. And then the other person is Julian Grout, and he is a trader whose job it was to make sure that he knew the correct values of all the trades. As you know, throughout the day, the value of stocks and bonds move around. And so it was his job at the end of the day to make sure the bank knew how much money was on the line.
So how did Ixell get the immediate blame? Why do we all know his name?
Well, he became famous because it was his idea to put on this really big trade, which we now call the London Whale trade. And so he had the idea to take this bet on stock indexes involving really big companies. And he went with the bet, and then he saw after a while that he was losing money, and he started panicking. Uh-huh. And he said, "I want to get out of this trade." And his bosses said, "If you get out of this trade, you'll lose money." And he said, "Well, I'm willing to lose the money." And they said, "Well, you know what? We're not. Keep going with your trade." And so they basically forced him to double down and double down and double down. And in his emails, which we know about from a Senate subcommittee report, he really expressed a lot of despair. He thought, "I need to get out of this thing. I am a sitting duck in the markets because everyone knows I have this massive trade and they're all taking the other side just to ruin my profit." And he was trying to get out, but his bosses would not let him. And, of course, we know then it ballooned to billions of dollars.
So if everybody knew that, why weren't they like, "Yeah, get out. Let's cut our losses"?
Well, it's really hard. You know, there's a – I don't want to use necessarily the gambling metaphor, but there is a kind of a gambling mentality when you're losing that much money. We're talking about billions of dollars. And it's really hard for people to accept – especially banks, to accept that they're just going to have to say, "Fine, we're getting out of this $1 billion of losses." I mean, $1 billion of losses is hard to accept. So what they wanted to do was hope that they could somehow turn it around. You know, like the Titanic is kind of going down. Maybe you can somehow pull it back up. But of course, we know it already hit the iceberg.
So why now are they saying, actually, Ixell won't be charged? Is there some sort of bargain that's going on here?
I would imagine that there is. And, you know, also, I think that almost as a society, we really owe Ixell a little bit of an apology because he was really painted as the villain in all of this, as, you know, the reckless gambler who took on all of this, you know, debt during the course of the trade and who listened to nobody. And that clearly was not the correct narrative. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's providing significant information. But also we know from a Senate subcommittee report that he really showed a lot of worry about the course of this trade.
Do you remember any of the emails in particular?
There were a lot of emails, you know, from him to his intern, you know, these kind of emails of despair. "No one's listening to me. We're really screwed." You know,
it almost makes you feel sorry for the guy.
Sort of, except, you know, it's really first world problems.
I mean, well, that's for sure.
Yeah, but he was a form of a whistleblower on himself, oddly, but no one would listen to him. So it's almost Kafka-esque. He knew what was going wrong.
Do you think this happens? I mean, you know, you talk to a lot of people in the business. Do you think this happens a lot where people are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place?
Oh, all the time. I mean, there are really hard decisions that are made on a trading floor, especially because you're between money, right? Everyone is there for the same goal, allegedly, which is, you know, aligned towards profit. But also, you know, there's this issue of autonomy. And a lot of people on trading floors feel like they have autonomy, but they really don't. And, you know, it's a constant, you know, pushback from leadership. This is, you shouldn't be betting on this. You should be betting on this. We're not going to let you do that. You know, they're very closely monitored and watched. And You know, and they don't always get their way. We see them as these cowboys of Wall Street,
right.
And that's not necessarily the case.
So at the end of the day, what kind of repercussions do you think we might see for financial markets from a criminal case against either of those two individuals who are higher up? Could we see potentially, I'm going to ask a silly question, trading become a more ethical practice?
Well, let's not get crazy. the markets themselves will probably be fine. And so will J.P. Morgan. I mean, don't forget, J.P. Morgan came through this just fine because it was a relatively strong bank. But what it does show is that it's part of a trend of regulators and investigators really trying to hold Wall Street to account more and more often. We've seen we saw an SEC win a case last week against a Goldman Sachs trader. We've seen the Department of Justice pursue Bank of America for mortgage-backed securities. So we're definitely in a kind of a new era of aggression on these Wall Street wrongs. As far as this London whale trade goes, it's not as bad as it could have been, right? J.P. Morgan recovered. The bank is now profitable. So, you know, the question of whether this is really going to be a deterrent to other traders.
Is this truly significant? I mean, I feel like every time we hear about something like this, they're like, but now they made all their money back and it's just fine.
Well, you know, I think that's an important point because there was a time when banks wouldn't be fined from this kind of risky behavior. But what's really interesting about it is that the DOJ is showing that it's willing to go after trading bosses, not just the lowest guy on the totem pole. And so, you know, if people are paying attention, which they probably will only do for a year or two because memories are short, it'll show trading bosses that they should be paying closer attention to the kind of risk they have on the line, even if their bank can survive the trouble.
Right. Heidi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian US.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.